Subcommittee on Rules, Elections, and Public Affairs, Tuesday, April 20th, 1999, 3:30 p.m., Hearing Room D.
Floor to the House Committee on Rules, Elections, and Public Affairs. Now open a public hearing on HCR 7. Peter, if you please give us a rundown on HCR 7.
Mr. Chair, committee members, HCR 7 honors and recognizes Chief Joseph and the brave Nez Perce for their historic and valiant journey in the name of freedom. The Nez Perce Indians, composed originally of a number of independent villages and bands, belong on the strings of the whites. They have welcomed Lewis and Clark, fur trappers, and missionaries to their homeland in the mountains, valleys, and along the rivers of southeastern Washington, northeastern Oregon, and north central Idaho. In 1855, Washington Territory Governor Isaac I. Stevens declined to increase in white expansion, negotiated a treaty with the Nez Perce chiefs, recognizing their people's right to their traditional homeland and establishing it as a reservation of some 5,000 square miles.
All right, and we have Antone Linthorn today. He wants to get forwarded. To testify. Antone, thank you for coming over today. You need to introduce yourself into the microphone for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is, good afternoon, Chairman Simmons and members of the Rules Committee. My name is Antone Linthorn, and I am the Chairman of the Board of Trustees for the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. I also would let you know that our reservation, the Umatilla Indian Reservation, is located in northeast Oregon, adjacent to the city of Pendleton. Pendleton, Oregon. First, I would like to thank Chairman Simmons and Senator David Nelson for sponsoring House Concurrent Resolution 7 and House Joint Memorial 12. We support both legislative initiatives and urge the legislature to adopt them. First, I would like to provide you with a quick history of how Representative Simmons and Senator Nelson learned of these issues. On December 22, 1998, we hosted a meeting in order to meet legislators from our region and to provide them with information about the Umatilla tribes and some issues of concern. Representative Mark Simmons, Bob Jensen, and Lynn Lundquist, and Senator Dave Nelson attended that meeting. This meeting took place at our recently opened Temuscaling Cultural Institute and included a tour of our permanent exhibit. Temuscaling is one of four Oregon Trail Interpretive Centers. It is the only Oregon Trail Interpretive Center that tells the story of the westward movement from the Indian perspective. The year of community involvement and development makes Temuscaling a valuable educational tool for and about our people. And it was at that meeting that we had discussed the need for the state of Oregon to honor Chief Joseph. We discussed it at that time. And from our point of view, Chief Joseph is perhaps one of the greatest people, not only in the state of Oregon, but throughout the nation and the world. He is recognized as such. And for that purpose, we feel that Chief Joseph needs to be honored. Chief Joseph and his Wallawa band for us represent the symbol of freedom. That is what that fight was. That is what that fight was about. And I think he has to be recognized for that, as well as Chief Joseph was a very articulate spokesman for the principle of freedom. And he is an Oregonian. And we support this House Concurrent Resolution number 7, as it has been read or as is printed. And that these statement also, I might mention that Chief Joseph also has blood relatives on the Umatilla Reservation, being that Chief Joseph is also of Cayuse heritage, and the Umatilla Indian Reservation has the three tribes of Cayuse, Umatilla, and Wallowalla tribes. So there is kinship there on the Umatilla. Now, with that brief statement, are there any questions or comments?
Thank you, Anton. Any questions from the committee for Chairman Linton? I do have one question, Anton. On line 27, do you have the printed bill in front of you?
On line what?
27.
On House Concurrent Resolution 7?
Yes. It says resolve that a copy of this resolution be presented to.
Yes.
Who would you like to see inserted there?
Like Umatilla, Nisperse, Colville, and Warm Springs, because there are Chief Joseph descendants on those reservations. That would be Confederate Tribes of Umatilla Indian Reservation, Nisperse Tribe of Idaho, and Caldwell Confederated Tribes, and Confederate Tribes of Warm Springs Reservation.
Could you furnish us with some addresses?
We will do that. We will provide those addresses.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I wonder if it would be appropriate to share this with the county commissions involved, or would they have an interest in this at all, or not? Wild County, Umatilla maybe, Union perhaps, or not?
I think it would be appropriate to do that. For Umatilla, Union, and Wallowa, those three counties would be directly affected.
And the Warm Springs, that's in Deschutes County?
Jefferson, right.
Jefferson. Okay. We've got that noted here, and we can take care of that.
Okay.
Any further questions or comments from members of the committee? Hearing none, we will go out of public hearing and into work session on HCR 7. I would entertain a motion to move that. Yes, Mr. Devlin?
Mr. Chairman, would you kindly please move the conceptual amendments first? To remove the conceptual amendment that I've been stated. I can make it easier. I'll move the resolution with a due pass recommendation with the conceptual amendments that have been stated by the witness.
Okay, I'll show them again, okay? Does everybody understand the motion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We need to suspend the rules to allow unanimous consent that we suspend the rules for the purpose of conceptually amending the HCR 7 to include that this HCR 7 be presented to the Confederated Tribes of the Indian Reservation, the Nez Perce Tribe in Idaho, the Colville Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs, and Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs in the reservation?
Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs.
And then the Umatilla County, Union County, Wallowa County, and Jefferson County. I believe that's accurate. So, hearing no objections, so moved. And we will move it before the due pass recommendation, and I'll be happy to share it. Okay, so we'll go out of work session on HCR 7 and open a work session, a public hearing on House at Memorial Number 12. And again, we have Chairman Linthorne here to visit with us about HJM 12.
Do we not have to vote on that?
Okay. There's no objection.
Then we don't have to.
We can. If anyone wants to object, I'd be happy to.
I had to vote my hole in all the time.
We could go back and just. We could vote
on the roll.
Okay. Yeah, you give us a summary of HJM 12, Mr. Moore, please.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, HJM 12 urges the Congress of the United States to appropriate the necessary funds to restore and redevelop Celilo Village. Celilo Village is one of the most visible Indian communities in the nation with thousands of visitors per day. The once prosperous center of fishing and trade has been lost in neglect, deterioration, and poverty. The Confederate tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation have committed to assist the river people and have prepared a detailed inventory of existing buildings and preliminary plans for replacing and refurbishing.
Chairman Minton.
Thank you. I would like to ask Lana Jack to come sit up here with me. Lana was raised in the Celilo Village and moved away in 1992 when her mother passed away. Lana lived in Celilo for 23 years. During our trip here, she shared much information with us about Celilo Village and the history and its people. She has expressed her support for the Confederate Umatilla tribes initiating this effort to assist in the redevelopment of Celilo Village and intends to see that the redevelopment is accomplished. And this is Lana Jack here. As you may know from a historical standpoint, that Celilo Falls, which is located near the Dalles, Oregon, was inundated in 1957 when the Dalles Dam was put in. And because of that inundation, the Celilo Village that was there initially was moved back, and new villages, new buildings were constructed by the Army Corps of Engineers, and that's what Lana was talking about when we were coming down. And Lana does have intimate knowledge of the village location and who the residents at that time were. But that was in 1957, and with the passage of time, those buildings and infrastructure are in disrepair, are dilapidated, and need to be replaced. And the Confederated Tribes of Umatilla, about a year ago, went on site to meet with the villagers and also toured the site to survey the Celilo Village. I might also mention, too, that Senator Gordon Smith was on site and has an interest in the Celilo Village. But our staff, our professional staff from Umatilla, did do the survey and begin to document all the problems with the village, and that has come out in that document, the Celilo redevelopment project, or village redevelopment. And I think that was presented some time back. So we have also been communicating with our representatives and have also requested an amount of $6.2 million for the Celilo Village. There is yet much work that needs to be done with the village, and we will continue to be working on that, but we do ask support from the state of Oregon to Celilo redevelopment. And I might also mention also that that the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial is going to be here, I think, around 2005-2006. And we thought that would be a good time to do something about Celilo, since it is on the main route of the Lewis and Clark Trail. And that is the end of my statement, and we do ask your support. Thank you.
Lana, did you have anything you wanted to add?
I've lived in Salila for a number of years, and in living in Salila, I have to say, you know, people ask, historians ask, what is it like to have lived in the once great Salila Falls? Well, it's almost kind of a shame to say, you know, that I've had to live kind of in inhumane situations where the houses can't accommodate, you know, the lifestyle that we've grown accustomed to in progressive America today. You know, we can't have a TV, a microwave, a stereo, a computer, a stove, a refrigerator, those kinds of things, modern conveniences that we've grown accustomed to. We can't have those things. And so I can remember for most all of my life running from that shame, you know, that I grew up with. But it seems over the years, in knowing my people and knowing the struggle that the people have been trying to make exactly what's happening here today happen, to be heard, to let you know the suffering of the people and how degrading it can be to be humble, to be impoverished in America, to live in poverty in America. There were homes put there back in 47, and they were given to the chief leaders, Chief Tommy Thompson, Chief Henry Thompson, Chief Yallop. These were leaders who came to you too back in the 40s and the 50s. They came to this place and pleaded for you to acknowledge what their rights were, what they had the right to. Did they have the right to medical? Did they have the right to the same social services that the Creek Confederated Tribes, that the land was entrusted to? The little bit of land that we talk about here today was entrusted to the Creek Confederated Tribes, the Yakima, the Unakilla, and the Warm Springs. And for 50 years now, we can say that this place has been forgotten, neglected. The people are abused. Our elders are dying in vain. The struggle that they fought so hard for, you know, they're passing us and leaving us just yesterday, you know, the passing of our people, leaving us who fought and struggled for these things to happen. To see too that we could practice and remember, you know, where we came from and who we are. And they trusted in the system, believing, you know, it was set forth by God. They were godly people. They believed in God. They loved Him and trusted in Him. And I have records of many attempts to gain ground and pursue things in letters to the Congress, in unanswered letters to Congress about what their rights were, what they have the right to. If you go down there and you look at it today, you see that they really haven't the right to anything except to be impoverished. And it's really sad. You know, I just hope that in your heart you can be touched by that today. Because the people there have suffered and they've survived, and now today because people can hear of the suffering. And maybe there's something that you can do to help bring about change to a place that was greatly known for trade, greatly known all across the world for the salmon that used to come there. The people traveled from all across the world to see this wonderful place called Salila Falls. And when it was buried, a lot of things were buried with it. The people were buried with that water too, to be forgotten about. One of the things in growing up there, the tracks that cut through the heart of the village, I can remember back in 1990, my mother was suffering with a heart condition. She had heart disease. And we didn't know that she was suffering with a cardiac arrest. and we were sitting waiting for a train to go by. This train was stuck there for an hour, and nothing, we could do nothing to move that train. So my mother sat in the train for an hour waiting for this train to go around. And it damaged her heart so bad that there was nothing that could be done, you know. Her ultimate thing that she, her reality for that, from that moment on, was to know that she wasn't going to be with us much longer because of the suffer that she had to go through behind sitting there and not being able to have a doctor attend to her and her heart being damaged more by sitting there for an hour waiting for this train to move. The bacteria, there's an ongoing problem of bacteria existing in the water down there. I live with it. I have to suffer with it in my stomach today. I've just gone through another series of antibiotics to clear up this ulcer from this bacteria given to us by the water. This is neglect to our people. This is true neglect to our people. And so suffering with this, I just say, you know, the many things that I have come here in representation of the people, Chief Tommy Thompson, Chief Henry Thompson, and the people that struggled, Abe Charley, to make something happen for that place, to bring back a sense of pride where people used to be proud, you know, and now what they have to be proud of. When you go by this, have you ever gone by Salado Village, any of you, and seen the eyesore? Oh, it's horrific, you know? This once great, beautiful place that supplied so much to this world, not just to our local economy, but to the world. People across the world can say they know Salado Falls for the salmon that it used to bring to them. And so we, like the salmon, are just merely existing, you know. We're near extinction, but we're asking to save us.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions?
Just a contact comment. You know, it's great you're here. I don't think there's a day that passes when I don't have an image of Salado Falls in front of me. I could type every picture in this building that is drawn or photographed taken. This rotunda, one of the four murals there when they built this building. There's a mural of Salado Falls. Down in one of the basement offices, there's a big picture of Salado Falls. In room 50, downstairs, there are half a dozen or so photos of Salado Falls. And in the tribal meeting room on the first floor, there are pictures of Salado Falls. It's so omnipresent in our lives, not just in this building, but other places. In my own personal life, I can think of maybe it's the only consistent dream I have at night, occasionally, a year, 5 years apart, but it comes back. It, to me, is images of the river that I've seen throughout my whole life, my parents, my father, talking about it. Every time I drive up to Columbia, I look out. I've stopped a couple of times. I try to imagine. Now, this was the center of civilization as we knew it in North America for 10,000 years, and I am struck always at what is out on the river, what it once was, and then the type of existence that is that you described very well. And I'm glad you're taking this, helping us help you with this modest statement that we're making through this memorial. And anything that I can do for many, many years to bring some dignity and help tell a story of what used to be there and what will return someday, long after we're gone, it will come back. It takes some solace, some heart in that. But I appreciate you coming and sharing your story.
I'd just like to further say and thank the Confederated Tribes for bringing it this far. The struggle of the people has gone on for a long time. Generations of my descendants have been struggling with this very issue to make something happen, to become, to see. They look down today and they see a representative of people here today. And a representative of the people who say we're going to stand for the river people. And the river people need somebody to stand for them. So I hope that you do make that stand as well. And that this is something that really happens. And we're just, because the Free Confederated Tribe should be held accountable. And the Umatilla Tribe is here today saying, that's what we're doing, you know. We're no longer going to pass on the fish. Because when people go out to get help, they say, you got to go over here. You got to go to the Warm Springs Tribe. The Warm Springs Tribe says you have to go to Yakima. The Yakima says you have to go to Umatilla. Nothing's done. Nothing is done. You sit and you have polluted water. You have to boil your water. You have to, you know, nothing's done. Nothing has been done. So I thank the Umatilla, Confederated Umatilla Tribe for bringing this about and bringing it to the attention of Representative Simmons, Senator Nelson, that they can initiate this and actually have Congress look at it, feel it, and do something about it.
Thank you very much. Further questions or comments from the committee? We'll go out of public hearing then on HJM 12 and the work session HJM 12.
Chairman Devin, move HJM 12 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Probably got a motion before us to move HJM 12 before the House for due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Mr. Wells, would you please call the roll?
Representative
Atkinson?
Aye.
Representative
Betts?
Aye.
Representative Devlin?
Aye.
Representative Edwards?
Aye.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Representative Maddox?
Excuse.
Representative Piercy?
What's your vote,
Speaker?
Representative Starr?
Aye.
Excuse. Aye. HJM 12 is moved to the floor of the House for due pass recommendation, and I will carry it. We're closing the public hearing on HJM 12, and thank you very much for coming here.
Thank you.
Now open a public hearing on, a work session on House Bill 2415. Colleagues, you should have advanced side amendments before you. We have that. Last time we brought them in, they were four. Yeah. Okay, I stand corrected. We have a dash of 4 minutes to the bill. And I assume we've all had an opportunity to look these over. We've had this before several times, and is there any discussion?
Mr. Wynn, no discussion?
Yes, we are.
Mr. Chair, let's move the dash 4 minutes into House Bill 2415.
Colleagues, I have a motion to move the dash 4 minutes into House Bill 2415. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so moved. Mr. Zier,
I move House Bill 2415 as amended to the House floor with a new pass recommendation.
I have a motion before us to move HB 2415 to the floor of the House with a new pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so moved. And do you have a volunteer for a carrier? President Devlin volunteers to carry HB 2415 before the House. Mm-hmm. We will close the work session on HB 2415 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 368. Dude, if you could just run down on Senate Bill 368, please.
Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 368. The staff summary is rather brief because of the information that will be provided by the election division. SB 68 revised election law. This bill is the annual ombudsman bill that deals with revising election law chapters ORIS 246 through 260. And the election division will provide the details of all the various areas that will be hit by this Senate bill.
Do you have the sign-up sheet? And no calling C lockers on it. And calling, why don't you come ahead and trust the witness stand. And
Chair Simmons, members of the committee, I'm Colin Seelock. I'm the Director of Elections for the Secretary of State's office. With me is Al Davison, who is Marion tonight's clerk. You should have before you a document that is my testimony that I will not read, and the document that Chair Simmons is holding up, which is a more detailed section on our summary of 368A. It is true that at every session, the Clerks Association of Secretary of State's office presents a bill that is primarily all technical housekeeping, things that need to be tweaked to make sure that we're still in compliance, things that have been missed in previous sessions. Unfortunately, that bill did not move last session, so this one's a little bit longer. I am not going to go through it section by section. I know you're under a lengthy agenda today, so I'm going to try to just highlight three or four things. Be more than happy to answer questions, or if someone wants a more detailed discussion, certainly can provide that in addition to the handout. This kind of bill has things in it like Section 3, which talks about allowing a candidate to file a withdrawal without a notarized statement. Right now, there's a three-day window after the deadline to file for candidacy where you could withdraw your candidacy, and that currently you're required to get that a notarized statement. And so this is just a technical thing saying we don't see a purpose for that, so would remove that. Section 4 allows nonpartisan candidates, normally judges fall into this category most often when filling a vacancy after the 70th day before an election, which is after the filing deadline period. It would allow them to file by fee as well as by petition. There's sort of a glitch there. Currently, if a vacancy occurs after the filing deadline, they must file by petition. That would be all nonpartisan candidates. The most significant portion of this bill is found in sections 5 through 18. In 1993, the legislature passed with some sunset language, changing the format, the layout, the keys, as well as the length of voter panel arguments. We used that format in 1994 and again in 1996. That language was repealed automatically in January of 1997. In 1997, the Senate passed Senate Bill 222, and the House passed House Bill 2202. Unfortunately, there was never an opportunity to combine those, to take the sunsetted language that we were all used to, the practice we had had in for 4 years, and roll it into the same bill so that it would become law. So, indeed, in 1998, we reverted back to the 1992 statutory language. I'll just briefly go over that, although both my testimony as well as the section-by-section is much more detailed. It does remove city candidates where cities are over 50,000. It removes the offices of Justice of the Peace, all county, city, and metropolitan districts, which we had to include in 1998. It reduces the picture size. The current size is 2 inches by 3 inches. Reduces it to 1.5 to 1.75, thus producing, as you can see there, a little bit easier layout to get all your words in that is easier to read, but at the same time, we don't believe reduces the picture in a way that would be detrimental to candidates. Restores the fees that we had in place in 1994 and 1996. Federal offices currently reverted back to $500 for that two cycle period, they went to 1,000. Statewide offices currently are at 300. They were also at 1,000 during the 94-96 session or election cycle. State senators, state rep races would go back from the $100 that you would have paid in the 1998 election cycle to 300. Also makes a very technical change, and in the days when you used to typeset, the common inches, square inches, was measured at 29.8. Today we're under computers and it's a lot easier for us to lay out 30 square inches. Reduces political party statement size from two full pages to one page. Also increases fees for the statewide party. It would go back to the $600, whereas in 1998 it was $100. Less than a statewide party would be increased to $300. We also had some difficulty. The current language does not allow us to print if someone is running unopposed and the next race following them in the pamphlet is also unopposed. Our current language requires that we print them and then a blank spot followed by the next race and a blank spot. This bill, as in 1994 and 1996, will allow us to print those on the same page. Basically, one other thing I'll make sure, it also raises the fees for arguments from the $300 to $500. If someone chooses, instead of filing a fee, collect signatures, it raises it from 1,000 to 2,500 signatures. Again, I would want to reiterate that all of these adjustments were in place and followed in 1994 and 1996, so there is nothing new here, except for in 1998 they had to revert back. That primarily covers there are some other things that are also of technical nature with respect to voters' pamphlets, and trying to just skip through to the more important, what we thought would be the more interesting, important issues for you. Section 23, if a political party changes its name, we would require that people would have to be registered in that party. It's a very common thing to happen in minor parties, and it's very difficult to track. So what we tried to do is say if the Oregon Green Party becomes the Oregon Red Party, people would have to be registered. Section 45, again, I skipped quite a few sections, but we'd be more than happy to answer questions. We did not have any statutes that created any sort of penalty for manufacturing or producing fraudulent ballot envelopes and secrecy envelopes, so we've inserted that and recommended Class C felonies. No person shall sell or buy any absentee ballot or mail ballot. That also would be a Class C felony. And basically, that's all I would point out. The remainder of the bill is primarily of technical nature, but certainly willing to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Seelock. And yes, Mr. Devlin, do you have a question?
Just a clarification. Mm-hmm. On page 2, item 15, we currently have a bill, HB 2001,
mm-hmm.
that's going through a review process. Is that any different from what we've been indicating in debate?
Chair Simmons, Representative Devlin, I'm glad you pointed that out. I had it highlighted and missed it. That is the exact same date. It's
okay.
By practice, we've been nailing it out that early, and so we recognized that 2 years ago, tried to change the date then.
Okay.
So it would be consistent with what I believe you're considering in 2001.
Mr. Davidson, have any testimony for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity. I'm just here to help answer any questions that may be answered from a clerk.
All right. Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee?
Chair.
Mr. Devlin, go ahead.
Okay.
I'm assistant to comment.
Okay.
And I'll restrain myself from the comment, but it looks like I have to raise $400 more.
Chair Simmons, if I might add, I did overlook the fact that this bill does carry with it a fiscal impact. It most likely will reduce the fees for publishing the voter stamp by approximately $700,000, and it would gain approximately an additional $150,000 in revenue because of the higher. So all told, they should profit by the passing of this bill by almost $850,000.
So $700,000 in cost to publish that is actually being recovered through filing fees and statement fees.
The $700,000, Chair Simmons, comes from the ability to combine things and make smaller books, thus they're less weighty, which reduces our postage. Then you have to add on top of that, because it's actually a two-part equation, an additional revenue of $150,000 goes directly to the general fund. It's not passed through our budget at all, but directly to the general fund of $150,000, and that $150,000 is directly related to the fee increases.
So what we have here is voter stamps that are going to have smaller pictures for those of us who like big pictures of ourselves around.
That's correct. That is correct. And Chair Simmons, in some races, like statewide races, in 1992 and again in 1998, if you were in a statewide race like this particular candidate was, you would have gotten a whole page. Mm-hmm. And in 1994 and 1996, we reduced that to the same column that everyone else gets and received not one complaint from any statewide or federal office candidate that they could not get their message across in just one column. So their fees not only went up, but the amount of space they were allotted went down, and it worked very well in 1994 and 1996.
Questions from the committee? I feel like this needs to be fleshed out just a little bit. The other technical pieces that are in the bill, where would you be if we chose not to pass this piece?
Excuse me, Chair Simmons, are you referring to all the voter pamphlets?
The pieces that don't relate to the fees and the size of the pictures and such.
Basically, the rest of the bill is the technical fixes. They're just technical fixes. The only thing that you would lose with respect to the voter stamp is the fees, and is you would be spending more with a higher likelihood that we would continue a two-book pamphlet in the fall. That's really a policy choice for you all to know.
Let's discuss that a little bit further on the having to run two voter stamps does cost the state a significant large amount of money, and by condensing things somewhat, what did it cost us? Last fall we had a two volume pamphlet.
Chair Simmons, that's correct.
And that was one of the biggest pamphlets we had out, I believe.
Chair Simmons, I believe the 1996 pamphlet was larger because there were more measures. There were actually 23 measures on the ballot. But it was still significantly high. It cost, just for that pamphlet alone, if my recollection serves me, about $1.6 million because of the two volumes.
This is Star.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much would it cost if we charged this full cost to print? I mean, each page we charge the actual cost that it costs the state.
Chair Simmons, Representative Starr, the best way that we have to figure that, because there are a lot of pages that there is no revenue generated. So there are pages of general information and arguments or measures. You have the pages that are devoted to text, explanatory to the fiscal impact statement. Basically, the fees cover about 10% of the actual charges. So you would have to elevate everyone's fees 10 times in order to make it self-sufficient.
What if, can I follow up? What if we, you kind of answered the question, but not exactly. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Couldn't we go through and count the number of pages in the document and then have it divided by the amount? We get per page, and I mean, some of the general information is necessary, required. Everybody ought to pay for it, everybody benefits from it. But the columns that are issue specific, measure specific, candidate specific, seems to me that there's a legitimate role or a legitimate other policies that could be argued that those folks should pay for those. Would that be possible?
Sure, Simmons Representative Starr. I used to think that would be a very easy thing to do. And what you learn after you've been in this business is there's nothing ever easy anymore. We actually produce 26 different versions of the voter stamp. So if you're a statewide candidate, you appear 26 times, and so you have 26 charges. If you're a representative that appears just in one voter stamp because your district is wholly contained within just Jackson County, then you only appear once. And so the actual charge that if you take it quite literally, that we would charge you would be far different than one of your colleagues from Eastern Oregon whose district might go through three or four different books. And so they would appear in three or four different editions. And so in order to do what you're asking, we would have to know a little bit more because the fees get really uneven. And if you're running a statewide race, you appear in all of them. So do you want to look at a fee that covers the actual cost of appearing in 26 books? Do you want to just try to break it down? I mean, it becomes more complicated than what I first thought. And that's why the way we've tried to do it is to say, here's what it costs the state. Here's what the revenue is for the state. The revenue only pays for about 10% of the voter stamp. If you want the revenue to match the expenditure, then everybody has to pay 10 times the amount. And that will vary according to race. And then, of course, it would vary according to how many times you were actually printed versus a colleague who might hear more editions. I don't know if that's helpful or...
That's an excellent explanation.
How many candidates are you in?
I'm in three candidates.
Oh, wow.
There's a new buyer.
Sounded good to him.
I'm also in three counties, but to the cost, is, are you talking about cost of printing and mailing, or just cost of printing?
Sure, Simmons Representative Byers, we're talking about printing and mailing the entire production process.
Well, so, yes, Mr. Byers, what would you, do you have a breakdown of the cost of just the printing part of it would be that, not to mention, if we don't talk about the mailing?
Sure, Simmons Representative Byers, yes, we do. I don't have it with me today, but we do have those figures available that actually break it down.
Obviously, that was greatly significantly lower the 10 times cost.
Sure, Simmons Representative Byers, I'd really have to do some research to see how that would parse out according to those divisions. But it certainly could.
Further questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
We also have Paul Snyder sign up for the day. Standoff going on.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Snyder, and I represent the Association of Oregon Counties. We have concerns just with one aspect of the bill, that is the piece that removes local candidates from the state voters pamphlet. It is for counties a matter of cost and for local candidates a matter of convenience, both for the candidates and for the voters. Last election cycle in 1998, there were 20 counties that did not publish their own voters pamphlet. And they included Baker, Crook, Grant, Harney, Dillon, Morrill, Sherman, Union, Wallala, Wheeler, Hood River, Jefferson, Wasco, Lynn, Coos Curry, Douglas, Lane, Polk, and Tillamook. Those counties, as I understand it from information from the Secretary of State's office, neither published their own voters' pamphlets nor published inserts in the state voters' pamphlets. So for those counties, this was the forum by which the information was delivered to the voters. And for those reasons, we would recommend deletion of Section 10 and probably, therefore, Section 8. I don't know if there are other conforming amendments that would also be required. But that is correct, my remarks.
President Byers. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did these counties that did not produce the voter count statement in 98, did they produce one in 94 or 96?
I believe some of them may have, and Ms. Seelock indicated that she would try and gather that information from the committee. I don't know if it's from them.
Yes, go ahead.
Chair Simmons, Representative Byers, there were four counties that did produce pamphlets: Coos, Crewe, Douglas, and Tillamook. Did produce pamphlets in the window of time where they were not eligible to be in the state council. And then in 98, chose Matthews.
Ms. Byer, so the follow-up, these other 16 counties traditionally have not done voter count statements, so it really doesn't affect them. It just affects the four counties.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Byer, I think it's a matter of if these sections of the bill as is currently before you have those 16 counties would have a choice, either in order to get, they wouldn't be able to provide the information in the state voters council because these sections would prevent that. So for those 16 counties, the choice would be to publish their own voters pamphlet material or do without providing information across the county on local election issues.
President Barr, which they have done in the past.
In two election cycles, I believe that's correct, in 94 and 96.
But prior to 94, they had to produce their own.
I believe before 94, they would be in the state voter pamphlet if they chose to be. And since 96, they're in the state voter pamphlet if they choose to be. It's only those 2 years, those two election cycles, I believe, 94 and 96.
Why was, Mr. Schneider, why was this not renewed in the 97 session? I remember that.
It's considered about 4:30 of the morning.
I think we've had this debate a couple times. Right. What is the cost to those counties to produce their own voter pamphlet?
Mr. Chair, my understanding is that it varies, and I would refer more to Ms. Seelock or Mr. Davidson to give you the answer to that. I don't know.
Chairman, for the record, Al Davidson, Marion County Clerk. I really can't speak to what it would cost other counties. I know in my county, for a primary or a general election voter pamphlet, we publish generally about a 50 or 60 documents, and the publication and the printing cost us right at $20,000 to produce that. That allows all of our city candidates in for all the 20 cities. Ours is a little larger than most because we have more cities in our county than any other county. We have 20 cities, and so that provides an opportunity for all of those counties as well as county candidates.
Hey, Mr. Davidson, are you publishing a voter pamphlet and issue pamphlet regardless of whether the state includes your stuff or not?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, we were the very first county to develop a voter pamphlet that included candidates and issues, and we were very proud of it, and our commission has supported it, and our taxpayers enjoy getting it. I get very many positive comments from it, so we do that.
Mr. Okay. Devlin?
This may be a question from Ms. Seelock here. If the bill passed as it's presented, would it preclude a county approaching the state to include, if they were paying for it, to include their material in the pamphlet?
Chair Simmons, Representative Devlin. What it precludes is for the county to file directly with us and that we take responsibility for all of that. For probably 4 or 6 years, we have been jointly producing voters' pamphlets where the counties insert their pamphlet that they produce, they print, and provide it to our binder. And that voter's pamphlet is stuck in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And that would continue to go on because in most counties it gives them a huge postage saving. And so that would continue to happen. This bill would not at all impact that.
President Clark?
if I could follow up on that, but the counties then, those that don't print their own, don't have that opportunity. So they would have to, in order to afford the opportunity, they have to print their own in order to get it inside, right? I mean, that's the option.
Chair Simmons, Representative Starr, that's correct. The difference, and it's a little bit, we've talked about it fleetingly, is in the state voters' campus, we will only accept county candidates, city candidates with populations of over 50,000, and special metropolitan service candidates. Whereas if a county chooses to print their own pamphlets, they not only will cover county issues and candidates, they will cover all the cities, including the very small cities, and they will cover all the special districts. And so what those people are getting is a full comprehensive, everything that's on the ballot would be jointly by combining the county and state pamphlets together would be covered. If the county chooses not to do that, and we've had some last time who filed their arguments and their pictures in both, and where it was jointly inserted, you would see the picture appear in the county insert and then again in the state insert because it is relatively inexpensive to candidates. So in the counties that have never published pamphlets at all, they would lose their ability to be in the state pamphlet. In 1993, when this legislation was first introduced, there was a discussion about what the state revenues should pay for. And it was that decision in 93 that it would just be state candidates. But that's certainly open to this body to reconsider. We only introduced the bill exactly as it was passed in 93 and passed separately in 97, but it did not become law. But it does have an impact on how many pages and whether or not we go from one volume to two volumes.
Mr. Chair, can I ask another question?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
On the one volume, two volume issue, obviously, in 96 was two volumes and you had the reduced size format. I recognize the 23 ballot measure. What cutoff point is it going to go from one volume to two volumes when we talk about ballot measure numbers?
Chair Simmons, Representative Byer, it really has to do with page count, and it has to do, we can staple the way the mechanism that we use, which is the most inexpensive but still effective, we can staple approximately 248 pages. After that, you have to go to a different binding technique that would be a glue and then a separate piece, and we don't have time to do that because we don't have enough time to allow the glue to dry. So it's really driven by how many pages and how many arguments are filed for measure. In 1996, we had sort of the worst of both worlds. We not only had 23 measures, but we were seeing 30 and 40 arguments filed per measure. And so it's that unusual combination. You might be able to have the same number of measures, but maybe not as many arguments filed, or vice versa. In addition to that, you have to look at the number of candidates because those pictures, and especially with the way the format lays out, and whether or not we can put races together or we have to keep them apart, if we get state candidates in full page versus a column, all of those things add to the length. And when you add to the length, the opportunity to move to that two volume almost in this day and age would be a given without these kinds of changes.
I guess a shorter question, maybe a shorter answer. In 98, would there have only been one volume if these laws are in place?
Chair Simmons, Representative Byer, yes.
Was there any discussion when this was passed in 93, Colleen, of providing an exception for some of the smaller counties?
Chair Simmons, I don't remember discussion directly on that. At that time, I do remember we tried to estimate where those candidates were filing from. And ironically, we got most of those filings from counties where there was a county voter stamp. And at the smaller counties, we still weren't getting filings from candidates. But that's my recollection, and I would be more than happy to go back to 93. We could even produce that for 98. We could look to see what counties actually took advantage of filing. And the 98 may be a little bit misleading because our understanding is there were a lot of counties unaware that it had reverted back more formally. So we could try to get you some 92 numbers where that was the common practice in human history. And then we could get you some 98 numbers and try to say, identify for you where those candidate filings came from and whether it would make sense. The thing that we would be concerned about is, would that then allow a county to say, well, all of the county offices can be in a state pamphlet, so we won't produce the pamphlet. But that doesn't help cities and special districts in those counties. More than happy to provide that as a way to do it.
I'd like to know how Mr. Snyder would react to that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, our position is with respect to statewide. There are a couple large counties that don't publish voter pamphlets, or larger counties, including Lane and Polk and Lynn. So I'm not sure it's a matter of population entirely. In many cases, it's a matter of economics, where the counties block the ONC revenues, federal forest revenues, and of course, Richard's 47 states. The cumulative effect of a lot of different factors.
President Barr, my only question is more to you. By large, you mean geographic?
Smaller. Smaller population, larger geographic area, yeah. Further questions or comments from the members of the committee? What's the sense of the committee on this piece of legislation? Devin?
Mr. Chairman, I know that Ms. Seelock and perhaps the others also do not want to see this passed out of this committee a couple days before Sine died. But it's a Senate bill. We have time on Senate bills, so if we want to discuss two of these issues, we should have a little time on it. I don't think a week or so would hurt us on the bill.
All righty. Thank you very much. Those of us who were here last, which is everybody in the room right now, we all voted on this once already.
Is that 2 in the morning or?
Is it 3:30?
3:30? Okay.
You find the records on how they voted on that. I want to be consistent.
Yeah. Okay. I think the fireworks had already gone off.
They had,
actually. Yeah. They had.
I'll close the public hearing then and allow this to gestate just briefly and bring it back up probably next Tuesday. Much more. We close it for a work session next Tuesday and we will proceed in that time. So we will, yes.
Does this go to waive the name?
I don't believe so.
There was a fiscal. Did I?
No,
did
you
see a fiscal?
Oh, it's the revenue? Mm-hmm. The revenue?
Yeah.
All right.
Actually,
Wrong. Bad question. Move on.
It saved the money, so didn't it?
Yeah, we're going to do something about it.
That's the Gordon. Kevin, would you please call Representative Mannix? You have contact with his office, however. And the House of 3097 is just a tap-tap to hang on to a relating clause to the request of Representative Byer to open a public hearing on House Bill 3097 and close the public hearing on House Bill 3097.
I should have said a little bit.
Would you like to reopen the public hearing, please? I'd be happy to do that for the comment on the bill. If we can find the sponsors of the other two majors that are before us today, Which one are you going to hear next?
Well, Representative Williams has wandered into the room, so I think what we will do is go to House Bill 3065 and then 3165, and just have a seat in the back room. There's one here, so Mr. Moore. I'm glad you're here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the excuse. I had another legislative duty to attend to, but I'm glad I could make it.
Well, we didn't excuse you.
Oh, I wasn't excused.
Yeah.
Oh, I was just absent?
Just absent.
Oh, well, thanks, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it.
Always take serious.
For the record,
actually, Representative Williams, I did put down an excuse, but...
thank you.
We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3165. Representative Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Max Williams, representing House District 9. House Bill 3165 is a bill that originated actually in the 1997 legislative session, and it directly dealt with the issue of the assessment of civil penalties for the improper or mistaken filing of contribution and expenditure reports. And in the interest of full disclosure, Mr. Chairman, I originally became familiar with this issue in my professional role as an attorney representing a client who had, in fact, I'll just tell you his situation. It was rather unique, and some of you might remember it from the 97 session. But he was the treasurer of a political action committee. A secretary who worked both for his business and as the bookkeeper for the political action committee over the course of a number of years embezzled money from both the private company and from the PAC. This was done in a number of different ways, but money was rolled from one into the other account essentially to hide the effects of the embezzlement. Additionally, as the treasurer, when he would sign the contribution and expenditure reports and file them with the Secretary of State's office, he would sign them, and then the secretary or bookkeeper would then doctor the reports in an effort to try to not show him the losses, but reflect at least something that would not cause further inquiry from the Secretary of State's office. When this was finally discovered, eventually an audit was done, including an audit of the accounts of the Political Action Committee, and this information was made available to the Secretary of State's office. There was a discrepancy when the attempt was made to shut down the PAC, and that led to then an audit which led to a revelation that there had been embezzlement with the PAC fund. A CPA was hired, a complete audit was conducted, and retroactive filings of CME reports, which reflected actually what went on, as opposed to what had previously been reported, were filed with the Secretary of State's office. The Secretary of State's office was frankly quite compassionate in their heartfelt feelings about this unfortunate situation, but essentially said under both the administrative rules we have adopted and the law, there's nothing we can really do but simply assess you the civil penalty, which was quite substantial. And so this led into a discussion about whether or not there ought to be a broadening of the mitigating circumstances piece of the administrative rules adopted by the Secretary of State's office for considering the imposition of civil penalties. In other words, the Secretary's office said, the only things we can really consider, despite the fact that this was unintentional and that you didn't do it and that someone actually committed a fraud against you and this embezzlement, you're still on the hook, and we're going to charge you the penalties according to the matrix. And we are not going to, those are not mitigating circumstances. And at that time, the Secretary of State's office really was mitigating circumstances consisted primarily of, for a late filing where you or someone in your immediate family in near death, so you didn't get it filed on time,
And I don't think there was really any, I'm trying to recall if there was any mitigating circumstances with respect to an incorrect filing. I think you were just flat out on the hook and liable, regardless of the circumstances that may have led to the situation, which causes people to wonder, for example, if your house would have burned down the day before. Under the rule, that would not necessarily be a mitigating circumstance. You would still be obligated to file the report. So the bill was originally put forward in 97 with this proposal. To my surprise, a number of other groups and individuals who had been caught up by the harshness of the lack of mitigating circumstance application came forward and testified in support of the bill. The bill was modified. What you see before you, unfortunately, is not the modified version of the bill, but the bill, I believe, is originally introduced, so it would require amendment if the committee were disposed to pursue it further. But the bill actually passed both houses by a broad bipartisan support and was unfortunately vetoed by the governor. And my recollection is it was Senate Bill 847 in its previous iteration. During the interim, a group of us met with the Secretary of State's office, and it was my pleasure to have to be in that panel with Representative Piercy, where we discussed some of these issues. And to the credit of the Secretary of State's office, an effort was made to adopt some administrative rule changes which would broaden the application to some degree of the situation that was presented to them. There is still, I believe, Mr. Chairman, a reasonable discussion to be had about whether or not a law should direct the Secretary of State to consider particular factors when it comes to applying the standard of mitigating circumstances in the application of civil penalties for C&E filings. I don't believe, in my own personal opinion, that the Secretary of State's rules go far enough. But I will give him credit for starting down, I think, the right path. Essentially, as it sits, it's really a very unfortunate situation where we ask people who get involved in this situation to take the responsibilities very seriously. But when there is a mistake, and the real issue gets to intent, when there is a mistake, an unintentional mistake in the filing of a C&E report, that there really is no out for that person who filed the unintentional mistake. So that was essentially what the bill, Mr. Chairman, was directed at. I filed it primarily to keep open the opportunity to continue to have this discussion in this legislative session with the Secretary of State's office. I don't know if I recall Representative Piercy suggesting to the Secretary of State's office in that meeting that it would be an opportunity this session to continue to have a discussion on this issue. And with that, I'd be happy to answer particular questions if you have any.
All right. Mr. Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Williams, what does this bill have to do with privilege tax and double taxation? Isn't that what the governor vetoes bill? Well, Representative Beyer, my recollection is what he said last time when he vetoed 847 was the retroactive effect of the bill. And the bill clearly had a retroactive effect. It would have reached out and essentially allowed the application of the mitigating circumstances to go to people who had not been finally adjudged in that situation. Certainly that included at that time my client. But it just didn't include my client. It included a number of other organizations who were still in the possible hearing or appellate process under the mitigating circumstances rule. That was the basis the governor gave, frankly, for vetoing the bill, for vetoing Senate Bill 847. Although this current bill, because I think what LC simply did was recycle 847 in its original format, still discusses retroactivity. I think we've probably moved beyond the discussion at this point of retroactive application of the bill for pretty much everybody who's been involved. But I still think there's a legitimate discussion to be had about mitigating circumstances. I don't want to speak for the Secretary of State's office. Secretary Keesling and I and Colleen Seelock have had many fruitful discussions about this issue. Their concern, frankly, is they don't want to be put in the position of having to define intent on these violations. And although I respect that position and can understand why no one would like to necessarily have to be in that position, it is my belief that as a quasi
judicial officer, essentially, in making these determinations, that's not an inappropriate thing for them to have to do. It is a hearings process. There is a hearings officer, and eventually then can be, the decision can be overturned with a hearings officer by a determination of the Secretary of State. And in that role, through our administrative law proceeding, as the Secretary of State does, in my opinion, act somewhat as a quasi-judicial officer. And like all quasi-judicial officers, I don't have a problem with him having some ability to examine the facts on the record and make a determination as to whether or not he thinks a particular campaign or candidate was acting with bad intent that resulted in this violation. But I could argue the other side, obviously, and I understand their concern about having to be in that issue. I think what this bill did in its final form, in its amended form, actually balanced some of those issues in a much better fashion and outlined some very specific things that they could look towards for purposes of mitigating circumstances. But that's the kind of the crux of the dispute.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to express my appreciation to Representative Williams for bringing this forward, and I think it's a good issue for us to discuss, and I really think we ought to try to come out with something about the mitigating circumstances that allows more fairness in that system. So I'm glad that we're working on this, and I hope we'll come to a resolution on it.
Great. Thank you, Representative Tracy. Mm-hmm. I'm sure if we do something and we refer it to the floor and the bill has to be reprinted, that Ramona would be more than happy to add your name as one of the sponsors of this legislation. And I certainly would be honored to have you. Yeah, I'd be honored to have you with me.
Thank you, Devlin.
Thank you, Representative Williams. It would not be a perfect way to approach this policy-wise. I couldn't really justify it. But on the mitigation, would you be open to something that would make them consider mitigating circumstances to fines higher than a certain level?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Devlin, I think the answer, frankly, would be yes. I think there are, I think there are some de minimis kinds of fines that potentially could just be, absolute with no discussion. And I'm frankly open to any conversation about this that kind of avoids the onerous impact. They're not here today to testify, but in 97 there was really some pretty strong testimony from everybody from the Mobile Home Manufactured Home Association. I believe one of the firefighters was involved, unions was involved, who had gotten hit fairly hard for, we're often talking about people, quite frankly, who are having to fill out these reports that are not either professional accountants, they're not professional campaign folks, they're the people who are sitting down with a box of receipts at their kitchen table trying to do the best job they possibly can. And they do make mistakes, and the mistakes are unintentional. Unfortunately, occasionally you have a situation like my client did where there was out-and-out fraud and embezzlement. He was injured three times, essentially. Once when a person who he trusted violated his trust, once when it resulted in a substantial financial loss as a result of the embezzled money flowing out of his company, and then a third time when he was forced to pay a substantial penalty for the violation. And this is, quite frankly, a person who I think took very seriously his responsibility as a treasurer of the campaign or of the political action committee, but still then relied on the professional auspices of someone in his office to handle the day-in, day-out management of the money. Quite frankly, to each of you as a candidate who also holds that same financial responsibility, I would just say there, before the grace of God, goes each and every one of us.
I think there's been Devlin as a follow-up question.
Oh, no, just thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just that I think if you were to modify it slightly so that it would be at a certain level, you might diminish the concerns from the Secretary of State's office, because I think their concerns would be, to some degree, I don't know how valid this is, but you go into a traffic court scenario, and anybody getting a $100 fine would want a hearing with potential of reducing the fine. But I do think there are some, you have a very egregious example there, but there are others out there, and you mentioned a number of them, where sometimes people, through no fault of their own, have ended up with fairly high fines.
Jeff, is there any back? You got a question?
Pass.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
With respect, this committee always
should. That's horrible.
Yeah. Not a part of any of my legislation.
I know.
I'm
wonderful to be here.
And Ms. Wimmer, did you want to testify on this House Bill 3165? I see
you have to down, right?
Written testimony here from you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the record, Lori Wimmer, LEA. I submitted written testimony because I didn't know if I would be in my other hearing, so hung up, but I'm here. And I won't reiterate every word in it. You can read it for yourself, but I do thank Representative Williams for bringing the bill, and we've worked with him very closely on all of the steps of the process that he's already outlined for you. And I would just like to emphasize the fact that I believe it is a fairness question. When folks who are just average citizens try to participate in the political process, we don't need to erect insurmountable barriers that fail the fairness test, that are so rigid that they can't contemplate all the various exigencies in people's lives. And that's exactly what happens most of the time. And when you're there self-reporting your own mistakes and get nothing but punished for it, I think all this does is create an incentive to not be quite so honest next time. And I don't think that's where the Secretary of State intends to go, but I think that's the net effect of the policy as it stands, and I think the bill would correct that.
Thank you. You touched on just a little bit, the honesty in the system. How would you characterize the election system in Oregon as compared to stories you hear from some states back east?
Chair Simmons, I don't know that I have any expertise to make that comparison. But I have always believed that Oregon's political process in general terms here in this building and elsewhere is more than honest. And I think we have a very clean system. I think we have clean elected officials. I think we have clean ethics laws all the way along the process. We have some of the most rigorous standards of any state in the country.
Thank you. Representative Williams.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, I just want to thank Ms. Wimmer, and she made the point that I probably should have made, and she made it very well, but there is really an incentive for people not to self-report their mistakes under the current law. Because, you know, no matter how good faith you are coming forward, the Secretary of State's office will essentially say there's really nothing we can do for you. Thanks for your good, thanks for being a good citizen, and now we're going to, you know, now we're going to whack you with a penalty. And that is a problem. I mean, the system, frankly, ought to reward people. If we really believe that the key to fundamental election law cleanness in this system is disclosure, when people come back to try to fix the disclosure problem because they have discovered an error, we shouldn't punish them for wanting to keep the record as accurate as possible. And that's essentially what the current system does. And I appreciate your pointing that out. I don't think my remarks made that as clear as I probably could or should have.
Mr. Chair, if I may, one further point with respect to the Representative Devlin's suggestion. The problem I see with doing a strict money cutoff is that, well, first of all, the current law allows anyone at any fine level to appeal anyway. That's a due process, right? So I don't think that would necessarily be ideal for a due process, in respect to due process. But the other point is, the way, if I understand the system correctly, the fine is based on a multiplier of what the purchase was to begin with, not the egregiousness of the crime. So if you're buying a newspaper ad in your local community newspaper, it's multiplied by the cost of that times however many days late you are by the basic multiplier number. We bought a TV ad, and that was $100,000 or whatever the cost was. It wasn't any more egregious than if we had misreported a $25 expenditure. It was just a larger number against which to multiply. And so I think the fact of the error and not the dollar amount is really at issue here.
Well, thank you very much for coming. And I'm happy to move the bill. If you want to develop some amendments, we'll...
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I would not want the bill to move out in its current form, and frankly, I would welcome, and I know they're listening here somewhere, even though we don't see them in this room, I would welcome a continued involvement on the part of the Secretary of State's office in working towards some amendments, and my proposal, frankly, would be to maybe use the amended version of 847 to pass both the House and the Senate last session as the starting point for discussion with them, and frankly, Representative Devlin has expressed an interest, Representative Piercy has expressed an interest, and with the permission of the chair, if I could maybe work with those two members, maybe we could come to some solution that would be supported by the majority of the committee.
That sounds very agreeable to me, Representative Williams. Let me know the progress, get the amendments developed, and present them to the committee, and we'll be happy to amend them into the bill and what we can do about moving it.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing on, let's see, Secretary Keith, and he has signed up. What I'll do is just suspend the public hearing on HB 3165 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2585. Lieutenant Manick still is not here or available. We do have one person signed up for the test on the bill. Mike
Kohlmeier.
Yes, Representative Atkinson.
At some point, could we, we wouldn't mind reopen the vote on
Suspend the rules and allow Representative Welsh and Representative Williams to vote on the
third bill.
HBR
7? No, it was 2415. Okay, do you have a motion?
I move to suspend the rules to allow Representative Williams and Representative Welsh to vote on HB 2415.
Always have a motion to suspend the rules and allow Representative Williams and Representative Welsh to vote on House Bill 2415. Any objections? Hearing none, so moved. Representative Welsh, how do you vote?
Vote aye.
Representative Williams?
Both aye.
Vote. Thank you very much, and we are now back in public hearing on, thank you very much for coming back. House Bill 2585, we have suspended the public hearing on House Bill 3165, and this is the last order of business before us today. Mr. Kohlmeier.
Chair Simmons, members of the committee, my name is Mike Kohlmeier, and this testimony is being submitted on behalf of 1,000 Friends of Oregon, a nonprofit organization with more than 5,500 members statewide. 1,000 Friends strongly supports the principle of full public disclosure of actual or potential conflicts of interest. Full disclosure, we believe, promotes greater confidence on the part of the public concerning the fairness and impartiality of the official acts of public officials. I think we would all agree that that is a good thing. 1,000 Friends opposes HB 2585 for the simple reason that it would reduce the level of disclosure required. Disclosing just the existence of a conflict rather than the nature of it clearly retreats to a significant degree from the level of disclosure currently required. Simply stated, we oppose amending the law to lessen the level of required disclosure and urge the committee to vote no on HB 2585. We appreciate the opportunity to testify, and I'll be happy to try to answer your questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kohlmeier. Is there any questions from the members of the committee? Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on HB 2585 and reopen the suspended public hearing on House Bill 3165. Secretary Keesman. And while you're coming, I'd like you to note that we are not going to move the bill today. I have charged, actually, Representative Williams has volunteered to help develop amendments to the bill, and along with Representative Piercy and Representative Devlin, and so you may want to...
I will temper my remarks accordingly, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee,
very much.
Secretary of State will tease me on House Bill 3165. I apologize. Senator had me on another bill that with some amendments we were able to support, which hopefully they'll move out. I'm here to testify against 3165. It is an area that obviously has produced a lot of conversation and discussion over the last few years. The public obviously asks for a contribution and expenditure system because that is, in effect, our only campaign finance right now of any degree. We have, of course, Measure 9 was thrown out by the courts for the most part. We've had a system of disclosure. The heart of this bill is to deal with the issue of intent. And I want to talk a little bit about what has already happened, particularly in the last 2 years since this issue was first brought up in the guise of Senate Bill H-47, which Mr. Williams worked on as well last session. I've enclosed for you just a matrix that talks about some of the changes that have been made. I'm going to refer that to you. We clearly have some cases where people brought forward issues of mitigating circumstances. And we ended up increasing two existing mitigating circumstances, filing officer error and valid personal emergency with three others: clear fraud, embezzlement, criminal activity, fire, flood, or other calamitous event, failure of professional delivery service. We also changed the calculation of days, which is part of the penalty, from actual days to business days. And I want to note that inherent in this is already mitigation, because in effect, the 1% is for the first offense, 3% for the second, 5% for the third. In effect, we have a matrix that takes into account whether this is the first time this has happened or is a repeated behavior. We also, on new transactions, which tend to be the area where we have the largest fines, decided to that there's a reasonable case to reduce the penalties in cases where the overall level of activity was relatively low, making a distinction between a $1,000 error on a committee that did all of $2,000 worth of campaign activity versus one that did $200,000 of campaign activity. And you'll see here how that matrix changes. I want to point out that under the matrix, which is governed by state law, the maximum fine is $10,000 regardless of the size of the problem. A $50,000 contribution that is forgotten and omitted on a C&E report, including in the last 5 days of an election cycle, is punishable at most by $10,000. A part of this bill would reduce that fine to $1,000 and actually perhaps make it lower. Now, I'm sympathetic with the argument about intent, but when you look closer at it, and we have spent countless hours doing that, you run into a problem of exactly how you determine intent. This is not an issue in most cases where there are many, many people involved to interview and try to compare stories to establish whether someone really intended to forget the filing or just simply slipped through the cracks. This also is an issue, of course, where people who have responsibility who then give it to someone else can then say, well, I didn't know because I gave the responsibility to somebody else. We actually think that when all things are considered, personal responsibility is important. C&E, contribution and expenditure laws, are something that provide a very important public service. And that we have made corrections for what we consider to be mitigating circumstances that make sense. We also want to put in context just what we're talking about. I think we had close to 1,700 committee filings in the 1996 general election. I think 70 of them involved any kind of fund, about 4%, and it consistently has how it has been. 96% of the reports are done with no funds and in which people meet the standards. So obviously, Mr. Chair, you've gone ahead with the work committee. We will be happy to work with you, but I want to be candid with this committee. I think changing the statutory framework to say that intent and having to prove intent in an administrative hearing is going to be necessary to get above a $1,000 fine level, regardless of the size of the contribution, is something that's going to be real difficult. I'm willing to certainly work with members of the committee, but we've spent a lot of time figuring out how you can work intent on this, and we believe the trade-offs are such that it is better not to go there. Instead, if there are specific mitigating circumstances that people believe ought to be added to our list, let's have that conversation. We're at your disposal, Mr. Chair, and I look forward to working with you.
Any questions? Representative Williams. Thank you. Secretary Keesling, it's too bad you were out of the room when I presented the bill, because I hope. And
yeah, I'm sorry too.
No, from the committee's perspective, I think I represented fairly your position and concerns about the bill, and but I guess one of the points I want to clarify for the committee is, it is possible, is it not, in a particular filing where you talk about the maximum penalty being no more than $10,000 for a particular line item that was not dealt with appropriately in a CMU report. But am I right that if there were multiple problems in a particular report, the fine could actually exceed $10,000 because it's essentially based on the individual error within a report and not the report in total? Am I right about that?
Well, I think Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, from the committee, I think that is right, but I want to double check that. I think we have, within a given report, some maximums too. I don't know whether that's reflected on the list. I can't remember, for example, a $50,000 or $100,000 fine within a single report. I'm more familiar with the cases where you have an error that will that may ripple through and compound for different filing periods.
Mr. Chairman, to your office's credit, I don't believe you typically try not to reproduce finding on those ripple effects, and I think that's extremely appropriate and to your office's credit. But I do believe that it's possible within a single report to have multiple errors that would result in that fine.
Well, for example, if there's several instances of, $5,000 missing and three or four instances of that, I think that's what you're speaking to.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The other issue that, and I know you and I have talked about it, we talked about it in 97, you and I have talked about it
98 and 99.
Yeah, this session, we continue to talk about this issue. How do we deal with the, how do you think we ought to deal with the issue where people who voluntarily come forward to your office with a voluntary acknowledgement that they have discovered an error in their reporting, that we provide them, no solace essentially for thanking them for being a good citizen and then finding
your fine. Yeah.
Do you not believe that somehow is counterproductive to the very openness and disclosure that you think and that I agree with you that our system ought to have?
Yeah, rather than going in terms of credit, I think it's the best question of all. I think there's probably been nothing more difficult in my role as chief elections officer than exactly that circumstance. Where someone says, I've come in to fix a problem. For whatever reason, the treasurer didn't keep good books, I want to make it all right. There are all these problems with, $1,000, $5,000 worth of errors. And it happened a while ago, and so the penalty that comes out the other end is equal to that amount. The difficulty is the intent issue, the solution to it. And I think that's where we run into difficulty. And so I don't have – we struggle with it. And we keep asking ourselves, how do you deal with that issue without opening the door to someone simply asserting – that this was unintentional or due on our fault, and you end up sending a signal out there that the system can be manipulated for purposes that are a good deal less wholesome than just simply trying to fix the book. And that's a rock we keep coming up against. And I actually welcome a chance to sit down and try to puzzle that one out. And I think you ought to look at the intent issue as a solution, the current system as a solution, or maybe to try to find some ways that perhaps we haven't thought through enough. But to me, my gut tells me that you deal with that best through a specific mitigating circumstance as opposed to a case-by-case determination of intent in varying degrees of intent. Are somebody half culpable or do they sort of have knowledge but not really? And you get into that, and it's particularly in the administrative rules process, I think you create much bigger problems than the one you quite legitimately want to try to solve. Similarly with the compounding effect. think you can address that other ways, like a cap on overall report things rather than intent. But you're absolutely right that that is the single, I think, most compelling example of where we ought to continually ask ourselves, can we do a better job?
Any additional questions for Mr. Casey?
Thank you for your testimony.
You bet. I look forward to working with subcommittee.
The hearing on House Bill 3165 is closed. There's no other business for the committee today. We are adjourned.
All right.
Yeah. We're running.
Ooh. Okay.